Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints, MJ Network, after my sister, Marcia Joyce. And we have a very interesting show today. Imagine a world that will soon be destroyed unless a young child can manage to eliminate the threat to the balance of power between all the different races and humans that have to coexist. Sound familiar like the real world today? Well, what happens when the weight of what will occur is in the hands of this young boy who is smart, protected because of who he is and what his father did for the world, is placed in a position, placed on earth by what happened to him in his control, and reactions will determine if everybody lives and where everybody dies. The young man's name is Lark, and I'm not going to say anything more. The author of He is the Child of Creation, and he's been placed here for a purpose. And you're going to find out what the purpose is as soon as we meet the author of the book, Robert Donahue. And I am so excited that you're here. This is book one of Then Came a King. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. This is fine. So how did you create the world that these characters live in, and give the listeners a summary of the book, just like an overview?
Okay. I'm a big reader of epic fantasy novels, and so I wanted to create a world, an epic fantasy world, that my characters could live in that seemed, at least to me, to be somewhat more realistic than many of the worlds you read about. You know, a lot of these worlds, the authors try to take things so far away from reality that it was more, you have to figure out how to deal with the people, and they're not always realistic. So I wanted it to be more realistic. I wanted that suspension of disbelief, you know, like you had the first time you watched one of those movies that maybe you got into really strongly, and you know it's not real, but it could be. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
So with the book, it's a child of creation, a young man, as it opens up, is found by an elf, and he's hiding. And it's a unique meeting, I think. I tried to make it that way. And that she's taking a bath, and he's hiding in a bush. And so then from there, they become friends. But he's not hiding in the bush intentionally. He was asleep when she decided to take her bath there. And so from there they become friends. And she finds out that he is by himself. His family has been killed by what he believes were raiders from the Eastern hordes that I haven't really developed real strongly yet, but they're the threat to the West. At the beginning of the book, and he thinks that's who killed all his family, and he's by himself. They've destroyed his whole village. They've destroyed everything he's ever known, everything he's ever been around, and now he's got to take what he's learned in his short life and figure it out and make his life work.
Yeah, it makes it hard. But, you know, what I love about him is that he's not one of these wimpy kids. He doesn't fall apart. So how do we know that he needs a little guidance because he's a little, out there, but yet he's very independent? How do we know that he could take care of himself? Because you like this kid, and you want him to be on your side if you need help.
Well, you know he needs guidance because,
well,
he's hopelessly lost. He has no idea where he is. When the raiders came and his parents put him on the horse and said, get away, he got away, but he wasn't paying attention. You know what I'm saying? He was just running
because
he was scared. So he doesn't even know where he is, much less, how to move anywhere else, because you got to know where you are before you know where you're going. So from that standpoint, you know he needs guidance. But also, he's the son of a hunter, which makes him capable of living in the woods. He knows how to feed himself. He knows how to protect himself in the woods. He knows how to hide. But he doesn't even know where he is. So because he's never been as far away from the village as he is now.
So it's kind of hard, yeah. So he meets Laurel. She's a tough cookie. She doesn't, you know, cut him any slack, this one. And maybe that's what he needs. So he meets her, and how do you know right away that they have this, you know, love-hate relationship, even though she's in charge, and she lets him know she's in charge?
When she finds him, she treats him just like what she thinks he is at that point, a threat. And so she tells him to get out, and she tells him, you know, to after she manages to get dressed and everything, she sees that he's a child and she's an adult, so she treats him like the child that he is. In one part of it, she's got some food to eat. Well, he hasn't eaten in a long time, and she offers him an opportunity to share in the meal. But, you know, you don't just get to eat. You in that world, you have to share in the process. And he decides not to do that, so she doesn't share her food.
Well, he needs to learn responsibility, and he learns it hard. So where is she headed? And she relates problems. She relates some problems. The world you created is not any different than ours today, but different groups trying to take over power and destroy the others. So she's headed somewhere. She's got a goal. So who are the people that are the rivals that are trying to take over and destroy everybody else? Sounds like the, you know, when you listen to the news today, everybody trying to do that.
That's correct. Laurel is headed to what's called the Great Western Fair. It's a gathering of all the kings in the lands of the West, the western side of the Great Divide. Over the centuries, the Great Western Fair, which started out as just a meeting of all these kings where they could get together and figure out some rules so that they could live together peacefully, or more peacefully, has become this big, you know, kings like to brag. You know, my country's better than yours at this and this and this, and they all get together in this one place. They all start bragging, and you know, then you get to saying, well, put your money where your mouth is, and so then they start, well, show me. And then, so there's contests, and she's headed to this Great Western Fair to compete in a contest, as far as Lark knows. And what's going on in the world at the time is there's these jealousies, petty jealousies, just like happens in any other world. And there's gnomes, and the gnomes, who are kind of cousins to the dwarves, are struggling with some political problems that they don't like the way they've been treated. And this group of countries, the Council of Kings, has maintained a peaceful interaction in these countries for centuries. But the gnomes are threatening the status quo, as it were. And so she's headed to the fair, as far as Lark knows at the beginning, to compete in this contest. But there's also this thing about the gnomes that keeps coming up.
Yeah, that was interesting, because I was waiting for them to get there, but whatever. We'll have to wait and see. So we have two other characters. Who is Seraph and who is Satagon, and how does Laurel come to meet them? And who exactly is she that everybody realizes don't mess with her? She's got power.
Seraph is the oldest grandson of Olek, who's established a trading post along the main caravan route to the Valley of Kings, where that Great Western Fair is held every 10 years. Seraph and his family built up the hamlet called Olek's Vale, which is a little town along the way, into a major trading post on the busiest road for people coming from all over the West, headed to the Valley of Kings for the fair. So he's a powerful guy in his own little world. You know, the world of the Olek's Vale. Sagittan is a very tough dwarf. He's one of the best swordsmen in the world. and he just happens to be the general in charge of the chieftain of the dwarven people. He's of his personal brigade, and he is a very down-to-earth, get-it-done kind of guy. As far as who Laurel is and why people will listen to her, I'm going to let that be a spoiler because I don't want to give that away quite yet.
Okay, and I didn't put it in my review. Figure it out. Okay,
be able
to
take the adventure with me.
That's why I said I just write the questions. Just, you know, I keep going. So if anybody doesn't know, I really read the book twice. Haha, I know. And some parts of it I read over just to make sure that I didn't, you know, that I got it. So we have Sadagon, and he's mean. How come he was mean to the prisoners on his own team? He's got a personality of some people that you read about every day on Google. Seriously.
He is a realist. He doesn't want to fight, but if you bring the fight to him, he's going to fight to win. Whatever that might mean. It isn't about cruelty for him. It's more about being efficient, about getting good done, whatever the job is at that time. And it's what's created his success at, for instance, being a swordsman, because he gets the job done. He learns and he builds his strengths, and then he uses them to his greatest effect. But as far as the things he does in the book, he does more out of efficiency because it's the best way in his mind to get the job done than out of cruelty or anything else. He just doesn't understand the concept of cruelty from that standpoint. Mm. It's more, that's how you get the job done. There's things you can do and there's things you can't do. You can't carry prisoners around with you when you're in a hurry.
That's true.
So he deals with them. And, you know, you also don't want those same prisoners. The reason they're prisoners is because they attacked him. Well, you can't have them out there behind you either, waiting to attack you again. So, anyway, he deals with the situation as he needs to deal with the situation in his mind to get the job done as efficiently as possible.
He does, too. I wouldn't want him to get mad at me, that's for sure. Oh, my God. So we have this Sadagon, and we have Seraph, and this was the coolest part of the book because his grandson is a real piece of work. Why does he have to take Ben Bentinor along with them, and why does he want him to go on the journey? And if he doesn't follow the rules, which I thought was the greatest thing to make this kid listen, what's the consequences? I thought that was really good.
Bentinor is Seraph's grandson. Okay. Seraph is concerned because he's getting old. He's getting on up in years. And he sees his grandson following one of his managers into a lifestyle that is not pleasing to him. He's a fop. He's one of those guys that dresses flashy and he's stuck up, you know, let them eat cake kind of guys. And he's really good with a sword. But none of those things are going to make him a good leader in the place that Seraph has built. And so Seraph has to find a way to show his grandson how to be more of a leader, to be smarter about how he lives his life and how he deals with people. And when Sagittan gets to Olex Vale, all of a sudden Seraph sees a way of helping his grandson to see that different lifestyle. And originally the plan is just for them to go together. Why Sagittan? Because, well, Bentinor's really good with a sword, and who better to take him than the guy that's best in the world with a sword? Because he ain't going to be trifled with. He's not going to be able to be bullied by Bentinor, whereas a lot of other people that he could put him with would be. So if he wants to ever run the Olex Veil, he needs to be able to deal with people in a better way. And Sagittan is the way that Seraph sees the best way to get him to a point where he's not so hard to deal with, not so abrasive.
That takes time because all kids feel that they know best, and sometimes you have to, you know, to have the consequences until you learn what's going to happen. So
that's correct.
Sagittan has, yeah, that's why I like this book. I think that I just put it on Facebook if anybody has, you know, so they know that I'm asking questions. And I'm saying this book, you know, even though there's violence, is really great for young adults and teens graduating high school to learn responsibility. So you never know who can learn something. That's, like I said, that's the educator in me. I always look for something that people can learn or some message that can come out. So how does he feel about Locke, and who is Talon, and how come he's going along with the group? That poor guy.
How does who feel about Locke?
How does Sagittan feel about Locke? Yeah.
Sagittan is protective of Locke because even though he's a warrior and he's kind of the tough guy, he's also relatively intelligent and one of the few people who understands few people in the entire world who understands the child of creation. And so he feels protective of Lark, even though he's kind of the tough dad. You know, he's a tough love guy, as we've already shown. But so he wants, he was assigned, and his job is going to be to protect Lark. But he also wants, he's really good at making points. Or at least that's the way I tried to develop him. And so he teaches Lark strongly. And I think in some ways that will continue. And you will see that coming up, spoiler alert, that he is very good at teaching. Tell him.
Yeah, he is. He is good at teaching. Sometimes they don't like the way they're being taught, but too bad.
Exactly. And he's a no-nonsense guy, but when he makes a point, it's a smart point. Talon is a handyman who is gathered into the group when a man who took him in as an apprentice decides he really doesn't have the skills to be a farmer. He was not a farmer.
Yeah.
He apprenticed himself to this guy because the guy was a farmer and he was a real nice guy. But Talon's just not a guy digging the dirt for the rest of his life. And the farmer figures that out. And he says, you know what? I need to find a way to get him a good life that he in skills that he can do, but I don't really understand what those skills are because I'm a farmer and I'm good at it. So he includes him in the journey with Laurel and Lark. And in that way, hoping that maybe Laurel can help him to figure something out. And so from there, Talon has to learn to adapt. He's got to become part of something he never even thought he would be involved in. And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, we don't have to tell anybody else. We're going to move ahead and not say any more about that. So then they come in. Why were they going to the council? And how did you create? This is so fascinating. The six councils and explain how they were run. And each council has someone else that's in charge. So that makes it hard, too, because everybody wants to override everybody else. So how did you create that part? Because that was really interesting.
The Council of Kings is
a
group of kings originally, and it's not. I'm not so sure it's really clear in how I write the books, but they were brought together by the church. And the church said, hey, can we figure out a way to get along? And so then they begin the process of building the council hundreds of years before this book takes place. Okay. As a part of that, they start building what's called the Council for Defense, because the Eastern Hordes that we talked about earlier in the book live on the other side of the Great Divide, which is this big mountain range, and they tend to want to come across the mountains. And at the point when the Council of Kings was created, through the Valley of Kings, to attack the people of the West. And they created a lot of hardship and a lot of heartache. Mm. And so the kings get together, band together to protect themselves from these Eastern Hordesmen. And then it just grows from there. But as far as each of the governments, I just kind of put together governments that made sense for the types of characters that they were in those various areas. And each government has their own history. Each people has their own history. But most of them are divine right monarchies from, you know, the Middle Ages kind of governments. And that's, I just kind of put it together piece by piece. Now, you got to understand, this book took me 25 years to do. So I had a lot of time to think about it. And to rework it and probably edited it 100 times.
Well, I'll tell you, it definitely was worth the wait. And I was complaining that it took me a year to write my last one. I'm going like, okay. And yet you have people that take, that they write like, you know, 10 books a year, or put out 5 every couple of weeks. Like, how do you do that?
It takes time to write something that too.
Yeah, I know. He's coming out with about 5 more. And I'm saying, like, well, maybe he doesn't write all of them. Maybe somebody else writes them. But, it's, you know, to write a book like this, it does take time. But I hope it doesn't take you 25 more years to write the sequel. No, can't do that.
Sequel is done. I'm in the process of checking it for facts against book one, make sure all my facts line up, and then, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. We got to see how book one does, and getting my name out is the hardest part. You know, Robert Donahue is not William Faulkner or, you know, Stephen King. So we've got to get people to understand who Robert Donahue is and what Child Creation is. And so far, I've been pleasantly surprised. It's been working out really well.
Do you have a Facebook account?
I do.
I do that. I put your review on my Facebook wall, and I put the fact that I'm on there. When I'm done with the show, I'm going to post the link out, and everybody listens to my show, and everybody reads my reviews. They do. People have read my review of your book. I liked it. Twitter is fantastic, and for my last book, I did a blog tour with Providence Books. And they do both, you know, thriller, and one is a memoir. And they're fantastic. And they get a whole bunch of people to review the book. And it's not that expensive either. And they always hang me, you know, hook me for a show for the, you know, an interview, which means that sometimes they get the blog tours for nothing because I do all their book reviews and everything like that. Or I get it for a lower price, so it's not bad. But they're really good. You should put your stuff, put it on Facebook and let everybody know that the book is out there. And
I am. I'm at www.facebook.com/booksbyrobertdonahue. I also have a website of my own. It's robertdonahue.net. And then I have one for the series, Then Came a King, on Facebook. If you look up Then Came a King on Facebook, you will find my series. And then I have Amazon, Goodreads, and Page Publishing websites.
You have to friend me on Facebook because everybody reads what I write all the time.
Okay.
And if, as a matter of fact, it's funny because one of the New York Times authors wrote something, and Robert Zagoni wrote The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell, and it's a memoir about a boy that has ocular albinism. And the book is so great, and he put it on Facebook, and he said, you know, the book's coming out. And I wrote, I just finished reading it because it's not out yet. It comes out in April, and a whole bunch of people pre-ordered it. And they said, well, if she liked it, well, okay, you know, maybe we'll pre-order it. And a whole bunch of people pre-ordered it. Yeah. So I don't know why. But, yeah, they do. They read everything that I write. And you have to get it more out there. And Twitter is great. Blurty, Stumble Upon, Scoop It is great. Goodreads is not bad either. They're good. But you never know. But there's a site on Facebook that I have. It's called Only Reviews, Requests and Only Reviews. So if you ever want to put your book out there for a request for a review, if you friend me, I can have you join that site too. But yeah, you know, I would, if somebody asks to review the book, I would tell you who to tell to review it. As a matter of fact, if you need reviews and you have the PDF and you want more reviews, I can ask a whole bunch of people to read it for you.
Have you got the hard copy book, or do you have a PDF?
I got the soft copy. It's soft. She sent me the paperback copy.
Okay. She can get you the PDF too. Either way, if you just send me an email, or you can. I think there's a contact the author link on my website that'll contact me directly.
I will after the show, definitely, because there's a lot of people that have read my last book, Daughter's Promise, and they're credible. And they didn't give me a good review because it's me. They gave me a good review because they thought what I wrote was good, was really great. It's a promise never to put my mom in a nursing home. So let's get back to these guys. Who is Pandra and who is Tepla? I like those two. I don't know why, but I do.
Pantril is one of Seraph's advisors in Olex Vale. He also happens to be the leader of a very influential guild in the Vale, the Thieves Guild. And if you want to know something about people in an area, ask the people who are stealing from them. So that makes him one of Seraph's key advisors. But he turns out to be even more helpful, shall we say, in the long run. And really helps keep the group that is protecting Lark safe. Tepper, and he was kind of a little flyer that I started out, and then as I kept creating him, because he was fun. He was a fun character to create, so I just kept adding things to Tepper, and so he keeps building. But he's a budding fan favorite now. I'm just going to tell you, because there's a lot of people telling me they like Tepper. So I may have to build him up some more in the next couple books. But he's a scout working for the Elven army, and he distinguishes himself just about every time he acts, it seems like. And so he ends up in King Forestan's private guard, and as a part of the story gets assigned to help save Lark, and that creates an introduction between him and Lark. But like I said, he's a fun character to write, and probably closer to me than any of the other characters, as far as that might be why he's so much fun to write. As far as his attitudes and his the way he does things, I'm not saying I'm really a good scout and everything I do is good. I'm just saying his personality and mine are pretty close.
That's interesting. I was going to say, how much of you is in this book? See, now you know. So now we have a world, our real world, of different people in our world of different races and backgrounds and colors, and we have protests and everything. So how can elves, dwarfs, gnomes, and humans coexist in the same world and actually try to get along? That's part of the point of the book.
Yes, ma'am. In this world that I created, it hasn't always been easy for them. There's been wars, there's been battles, and all of the various governments have fought each other over time. But the church, and that was one of the areas when I started writing, the church is never a central aspect generally of the government building or whatever in fantasy novels. It's more, you know, outside of the church. But I wanted the church to be a part of what's going on and not some crazy religion that's outside of more of a realistic type of religion. And so they create the influence that puts people together inside of the Western world and that makes them different from, say, the Eastern hordes or any of the other, you know, problem areas. And so bringing everybody together around the central church helps to build this world and this government into what it is. And I think that's an important part of this world too. We need to spend more time learning the lessons of the church as far as bringing us together and helping us to build our lives together.
That is very, very true. But unfortunately, the people in the news don't actually see it that way. So Locke's father was a powerful man. And tell us about him and why so many of the other characters, they don't want anybody to know who he really is, who Locke really is. So why is he protected and why don't they want anybody to know who his father really was? They want to keep that secret.
He is an important character in the story. And as some of the best stories that are written, one of the more important characters, he's also dead before the story ever begins. Mm-hmm. But he is important not only because he's influenced many of the lives of the main characters in the story that Locke doesn't even know he knows, but he's also an influential member of society who's listened to by kings and soldiers all over the world. And so even if Lark's father wasn't an important person, and Lark doesn't know because he's never left the village. Now, his father takes trips every so often, but Lark doesn't know where he's been going because he's a kid. And he does, you know, kids don't worry about where dad goes. They just know he's going on a business trip and he'll be home after a while. But even if he wasn't an important person in the world, he's influenced so many lives during these business trips that he's gone on that Lark would probably be protected by a lot of people just because he's Rockland's son. However, there's more to that story, but I'll let the readers find that out as they get into it.
Well, they have to understand that this is a book that's really long, but you have to take your time reading it to absorb each section and each part, and it's worth the read. Because, like I said, it usually doesn't take me that long to read a book, but I wanted to make sure, because there were so many different elements and so many different plots and subplots, that I got it right. So what abilities will he have to learn? Because there's an inner voice that tells him that he's called the Child of Creation, which is the title of the book. And who is this inner voice, and what is Locke going to have to learn in order to survive or everything? It's sort of like a coming-of-age story I wrote, the balance of power, betrayal, self-realization, and trust. So how is he going to deal with all of that?
Locke has a really long road to travel to become whatever he's going to be. If he's going to survive to tell the story about what happened in his village, which is originally why everybody's trying to protect him, he's got to learn. First, he's got to learn to protect himself from those who would want him not to tell the story. Because if he tells the story, it might create a backlash. Because while he thought it was the West Eastern hordes, maybe not so much. And other people know this. You know, he's just a kid from a village, as far as he knows. But he's got to learn to protect himself from anybody who would want to stop him from telling his story, and not just protect himself physically by learning how to fight with various weapons, but mentally as well. And the voice, which he believes is God talking to him, because nobody else knows about the voice in his head. He just has always had that voice in his head telling him, helping to keep him calm, guiding him when he's headed in the wrong direction, that kind of thing. But the voice in his head helps him when he gets to that point where he's so frustrated he can't think clearly, and helps kind of calm him down and take him in the right direction. And as the story develops, teaches him little things as you go along. And that voice may become more important as the story continues past book one.
I think everybody needs a voice like that. I think every kid needs a voice like that. Yeah, me too, because it sort of centers him, and it helps him to function and to focus. Now, before I forget, because I don't want to forget, Monday at 10, New York Times author Matt Coyle will be here for Blood Truth. That was a good book. On February 1st, New York Times author Dennis Palumbo, Head Wounds. On February 8th, Kate Genovese and Michael Emery, we're going to talk about their books that related to opiate addiction. On the 13th, The Shepherd's Calculus. On the 15th, No Fury Like That. It's a story about a young girl that winds up in purgatory and how she gets there and how she deals with it. Interesting book. On the 19th, I am redoing my show, The Last Word, of Oscar Wilde, because we had some technical difficulties and interference and static, so I'm doing it over. John Vanderslice will take spotlight. On the 21st, The Book of Lovers. It's a poem. It's really interesting. It's a sort of like a ballad poem about two lovers and what happens to them. On the 26th, New York Times author Vincent Zandri, The Detonator, and be careful when that book implodes, seriously. And on the 28th, to end the month, Who Better Than The Voice Inside by Brian Freeman. And that's just February. I haven't even begun to tell you about March. I've got, this is why doing what I do is fun, because it's just great to have authors like yourself and everybody on the show and be able to spotlight the work of other people. It's really fun. So how does Locke deal with Laurel and Seraph's grandson? How does he deal with Venator? Because Locke is fantastic, and I think maybe everybody needs one, a friend like him. I like him.
Well, Lark grew up in a small village.
What do you mean?
And he's an only child who's never really had to have that. You know how children who grow up in big families are really tend to be more competitive because they have to be inside the family dynamic. But he's an only child. And not only is he an only child, but he's an only child who grew up in a very small conservative village. So meeting this stuck-up, snooty, flashy dressing kid or guy is like, holy cow, what is this? I don't even know what this is. And so, but Lark's got a lot of his father in him. And his father was really good at helping people over time. And so Lark kind of just is himself. He acts himself with this guy, and then, you know, he learns when he first meets them, all he can do is laugh, because he's like, these aren't real. This can't be a real person. This has to be an actor or something. But then as he learns that, you know, this guy is a product of his environment, then he's got to learn. Then he's Lark as a kid himself has to figure out how to help this guy be a little more humble. And so that's what he tries to do, is help Ventanor become a little more humble.
That's a hard one. I mean, I dealt with students for 36 years in a public school, a tough one in the Bronx, and it's one of the things that you try to teach everybody how to get along, and they did, with a lot of peer mediation and everything like that. As the dean, you have to work like that. So I have a whole bunch of more questions. I don't know if we're going to get to all of them, but we'll see. What kind of training does Locke undergo, and what is he trying to do, and why? He has to learn how to do a whole bunch of things.
He does. he does. Well, as the hunter's son, in this day and age that he lives in, his father taught him how to use a bow. And Lark feels like he's pretty good with a bow. But then he meets Laurel, who is really good with a bow. And, you know, so then she wants, if he's going to go with her, she wants him to be her apprentice and teach him more skills with the bow, because it's something he's been learning as he's growing up, and maybe that's something they can share. So that's one thing that she's teaching him. But then as the story develops, he needs to have a more personal way to protect himself, because these people that don't want him telling his story are trying actively to kill him as he's learning how to live his life without parents, without, you know, anybody he can really trust. All of a sudden now people are on top of that trying to kill him. And so then he's got to figure out, well, who do I trust to teach me these kind of things? And so then he learns that. Plus, along the way, he's got to figure out, because he's never left his village, you know, I guess it's, I grew up in New York State, up in Syracuse, in upstate. And then I moved down to Vicksburg, Mississippi, which is probably a city, it's what, maybe the fifth largest city in the state of Mississippi, where Syracuse, at 600,000, is the fourth largest city in New York. Vicksburg, at 25,000, was the fifth largest city in the state of Mississippi. So I kind of understood the big city, small city dynamic. And that's something he's got to learn as well, because he grew up in a small village, away from all the big city, urban kind of environments. And he's got to learn how to deal with people outside of that, people you've always known. You know, small towns are way different from big cities. And so he's got to learn that kind of how to deal with people too, you know, the liars and the thieves and that kind of stuff. Cause he's really kind of innocent when he comes out of the village that he came out of. So he's got to learn all along the way.
Well, before they get to the Western Fair, but that's in the next one, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I have 15 more minutes, but I want to ask some of these important questions. I went overboard. You could tell I really read the book and got into it, because I don't normally come up with 50 questions for a book. Like, okay, 25. So we've got a character that you can talk a little bit about, Kisten, and he's whoever he is. Why did you include him? I don't want to say too much about him. I'm careful.
Stan is Seraph's right-hand man. And Seraph chooses him because he's very good at certain things that Seraph doesn't want to get his hands dirty doing.
Yeah, I know.
However, when you choose, you know, when you lay down with dogs, you end up with fleas. And Kistan creates a lot of fleas. In fact, Kistan is the one that creates Bentnor the way he is. So Kistan has his own little plans in place for himself. And so he becomes a real problem along the way in the story.
Yeah, he does. So
is that a fair way to put it?
About that. Yeah, because you're not going to like him. That's all I'll say about that. Okay, so we have Seraph and Sadagon, and they don't exactly get along when they first meet. But who is King Pridefall?
He is the king of Cantoria, which is the country farthest west of the Western Kingdoms, the country least worried about Eastern invaders, but also highly involved in the King's Council. And in his country, it's a little bit different from the other worlds, because they don't have as much worry about being, you know, attacked by Western Raiders, they're more worried about outside problems. But King Fridafall, and I think you'll find out he's pretty influential down the road, is one of those kings that is important to the Council of Kings for a variety of reasons. Because without him in place in the far west, any threats that might be out there farther west would be a problem. And so all of that isn't made clear in the first book. So some of that is some letting you know a little bit ahead of time about some things in maybe the next book.
I can't wait to read the next one, really, seriously. I just sent you a connection on LinkedIn, too. My cell phone loves me today, I guess. So, who is Colwyn, and why are they invaluable to the quest and the journey? And Benatar has to learn a whole bunch of things, too. So does he ever realize that he's there for a reason and that he's not going to get away with all this stuff that he did before?
Colwyn is Pradafall's youngest son. He's unlikely to become king. He is the third child, so he's unlikely to be effective in the government of his country. But he's a very strong warrior. In fact, his name is after the most legendary warrior of his people. And he becomes valuable as a friend and trainer to Lark at some point. And then Bentinor begins the process of learning hard. It's hard for him at first. And it takes time for him to figure out what needs to happen over time. And so learning that humble attitude is not easy for Bentinor. And it takes him time, and it takes some tragedy and maybe some things to go not the way anybody would expect them to go if they were headed that direction. You know, he thought he was the up-and-coming guy. He had all the nice clothes, and he could fight better than anybody in his little village, and he was going to be, you know, king in his own little world, his own little kingdom. But then things are not always go the way you plan them, you know, when you're young. So he has to take a step back and reevaluate and relearn and then rejigger his plan and figure things out while as a part of a group that is pretty much all figuring things out.
Yeah, I know, that's hard. A lot of kids can't figure out anything. So, I'm getting there. As the journey begins, they meet up another character that you have to bring her back, and that's Twi'let. She's smart, she's astute, and she was a slave, but she emerges as somebody more important. How does she wind up to be a commander and a general? And how did you get her in there? And who helps her and why? I really like this character.
I'm hearing more about that particular character than any other character I have in the story. Twi'let is...
Yeah, I picked it out. See that? Not bad.
and that's just everybody who reads the story really likes Twi'let. And yes, she will be influential on through the story continuing. But that's a story for another time. Right now, she is more, I mean, when we meet her, she's a prostitute and a slave.
Mm-hmm.
But she's a dwarf. She's not a human prostitute or a slave. She's a dwarf. And for some reason, Vagiton takes a liking to her and decides he wants her to join his group. And all of a sudden, things change. And where originally she was just kind of a side character in the whole thing, all of a sudden she becomes pretty influential because another group of people who know more about a society than most others are the prostitutes. You want to learn something about a person or about a group of people, become a prostitute because people tell their lovers things they don't tell others. And so she is very effective at gathering information. And using that information will be important later in the story. How's that?
Well, that is very true. So before we end, because we have about 5 minutes, we have two more characters. We have another character. Corphanon held the Cantorian proxy and appeared to have 10 votes. This council was really interesting. And we have the Podians have continued the diplomatic ties with them. So how did you create the sort of like the political parties or the political groups in this particular book? Because there's a whole bunch of them. And which one's the most powerful?
Well, it was about kind of developing, you have to create, as an author, you have to create conflict. Because without conflict, the story just kind of, if everybody's happy, free, then there's no story, really. There has to be some drama that goes along the way. Well, to create the drama, and I have a map, and I drew a map for myself so I could keep everything straight. And I was going to include it in the book, but I've been having trouble finding it. I'm probably going to end up having to redraw it because I drew it 20 years ago and in pencil. In fact, most of this book was written in pencil first. Just sitting in my office. This was before laptops and computers were really big. People had them, but I wasn't good at typing. Now I love my laptop, but most of this book was written in pencil, so I could erase and start over and do everything. And I've got the original copy somewhere. I just haven't been able to find it. But anyway, to create these governments, you had to create conflict. So I started with a map, and then I started looking at, why would there be conflict? And I just built up a backstory of conflict within the governments. And I think I did a decent job of creating international, jealousies and petty things that would happen. I also was a international police advisor in Iraq for a year.
Nice.
A year in Iraq, teaching Iraqi police. And so I got to learn firsthand how those things, because we were at the time, it was 2004, we were building the Iraqi government out of nothing, basically. We were taking people and putting them together and helping build police force that people could trust instead of one that was just the hands and the weapon of the rulers, So some of that comes naturally from being a police officer, but most of it came from just looking at, this is the world. These people might be, might not like each other for this. And I just built that up as much as I could to create a world where there was some conflict that needed to be resolved.
That was interesting. My nephew spent a couple of tours in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, and right now he's in Germany. He's a career person. He's been in the army since he's 18, and he's 28. I can't believe it. So, before we end, what is next for all of these characters? I just posted the link of the show on Facebook. I sent it to Leslie. She's got the link, too, and she sent me your email, so I sent you an email, telling you that I can get you more reviews if you want them so you can answer it. But this has been a lot of fun. This is interesting. So what's next for the characters and what's going to happen? Give us just a touch of what happens if and when they ever get to the Great Western Fair.
I don't want to say that. Okay.
Okay.
The next part of the story... I got to be careful because I know what happens not only in book two, but book three. I've got a good portion of book three.
I want to know too.
And so it's hard for me. In book two, you're going to learn a lot more about the governments. You're going to learn a lot more about the conflicts that are going on within the Western world and the Council of Kings. And maybe you'll learn a lot about the world because, well, the Great Western Fair is going on, and it's a big gathering of all of the greatest artisans, excuse me, artisans and warriors, and all of that in the entire Western world. So maybe you'll learn more about the world itself by coming through the Great Western Fair with me. But, you know, the great thing about writing this book is that it was almost like creating a, you know, the story was surprising to me sometimes in the directions I took with it. So it was kind of fun in that way. I'm kind of addicted to the writing part because I get to surprise myself, you know, with things. And that's kind of fun and interesting for me now. It's a lot more fun and interesting than just reading what some other person surprised me with. I can surprise my own self. So,
did you self-publish this?
Through Page Publishing out of New York, and it's kind of a hybrid between self-publishing and I paid to have it published, but they did some. Publicity stuff. They had an editor. They helped me with the illustrations. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a hybrid between self-publishing and regular publishing through one of the Big Five. And hopefully I'll get noticed by one of the Big Five and they'll say, hey, this one's worth an extra shot. Maybe we can try and get book two.
Well, I went with a new publisher for my last book, and they're a traditional publisher, and basically all it cost me for were like the administrative fees to buy, you know, for them to send me copies of the books. It was very little. They do publicity for me on Facebook every week. They got me my book one cover of the year for 2017, and they put it in for the forward reviews cover book of the year. EditaPros is fantastic. They don't charge. They're, like I said, a traditional company. They charge me maybe $300 to get the book published. And that was just for the administrative things, you know, for the not even for the editing or anything. Just for the, you know, the buying the cover and just putting the book together itself. It was really not a lot of anything, considering that self-publishing, the first time I did, I won't say which company that I would never use, cost me over $1,200, and it was a ripoff. Because a lot of these companies say that you have to pay for the Library of Congress or the copyright, and it should be included in everything. So I found that they're going to get my next book, too, when it comes out, as soon as I finish writing it. That will be good.
What's the name of that company?
EditaPros. I'm going to send it to you in an email. I'll send you the email from them, and I'll send you their contact information. It's Jeff Marsh and Marty Child. I wouldn't say it, but they did my daughter's promise, and they even got me a stint on a regular radio show 2 weeks ago. I was on KLC, 560 AM. John Rush to Home, and I was like, oh my God, I'm on a real radio show, and it's not block talk. It was real. And every week they put out like emails to different radio stations hoping that they'll get me some more. So I've never met people like this.
I would like to throw a shout out to Leslie at PR by the Books. They've done a great job getting my name out for me and helping me to create a brand.
Are good.
That, so I did want to get them some publicity while I'm here on the radio. And if anybody needs help getting their book publicized, they do a great job.
Yeah, they do. And Leslie has a habit of just sending me the book. Yours, she asked if I wanted to read. Basically, she just sent them. I've been working with PR by the Book for a very long time, and they're really great. I just sent her the link for the show. She's going to post it on social media and make a big deal out of it. Trust me.
Okay.
So I won't. Yeah, it is cool. I want to thank you so very much for today. I think the rain is starting to go away. It must have gotten the message from Mississippi that New York doesn't want rain. And
there you go.
Nice. Thank you so very much. And when you get the next one, I want a copy before it comes out so I can write something beautiful about it.
All right. I will sure make that happen.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a nice day, and bye.
Bye-bye.